Evening, everybody. Welcome. So we're having the second week of a six-week seminar called The Heart of the Matter, The Heart of the Matter. And in the center of our study, we have a short Buddhist text called the Heart Sutra, appropriately enough. But really, our topic is our life, our actual life. And so, I don't know what I'm supposed to say about your life. Maybe you should give the talk. But it seems to be my job, so I'll say something. And we can use these sort of expedient means of this ancient Buddhist text, which tonight we'll get into some sort of Buddhist lingo and Buddhist psychology, so it might get a little bit heavier. We'll try to lighten it up a little bit. But I've got a flip chart and no PowerPoint, but I have a flip chart. We'll see how that works. That's on the other one, I guess. That's okay. But before we get into that, just a few housekeeping announcements. And this seminar, you know, is part of our practice period, so a time where we're really trying to be sort of in maybe a little more deliberate relationship with our spiritual practice, and that seems to involve including other people. And so we suggested that you might want to have like a practice period partner. And in the process of signing up, if you did sign up, and it's okay if you didn't, you know, we're pretty flexible, there was an option to have us pair you with somebody, so we did pair a few people with each other, so that happened. But I just want to mention that in case you didn't check that, or you didn't notice it, or you didn't sign up. If you want to mill around a little bit at the end tonight and see if there's somebody that you'd like to, you know, be in sort of this special relationship for the next few weeks. It's not a heavy thing. Just in someone else whom you know is, for these weeks, trying to be a little more attentive, trying to be a little more awake, a little more alert. And how wonderful to get to have a few conversations with somebody else in those shoes, you know, the same shoes as you. So that's one thing, practice period partners. And is there anybody who did check that little box that expected to be paired with somebody that never heard from us? Okay, good. So that's one thing. Another thing is there are a number of upcoming events this weekend and 2 weeks from now, a few of which were not even on there. Even though there's already a gazillion events on the website, there were a few not on there which were added. So let me mention just a few upcoming things to get that in your mind. This weekend, Saturday, in addition to our usual early morning practice at 6 in the morning, we're having a little more schedule-friendly Saturday morning practice, which we're going to try doing once a month. Starting at 9:30, there will be meditation instruction and meditation and a Dharma talk, which I'll give this time, and a chanting service, and we'll end at around noon with some delicious homemade cookies. So that's Saturday morning, 9:30 to noon. If you're an experienced meditator, you could come for meditation at 10, but even if you've sat before, it might be interesting to see, you know, what's the instruction at 9:30 to come with an open mind. You could come. And then on Sunday, more instruction is available. On Sunday, we're having a class, a four-hour class, from 9 o'clock till 1 o'clock, led by Edie Norton and John. Who's our coordinator of that little series. We have a four-hour class about once a quarter called Introduction to Zen. So that's on Sunday, so you could really spend a lot of time here this weekend if you wanted to. And then the two things that I just added to the website are happening. This was the first Saturday of the month, right? February just started. So I added two things for the third weekend of the month. On the third Saturday morning of the month, we'll have a morning of quiet work practice, which is really a central thing in Zen, which we have not that much implemented. We do work during our retreats, but the work that happens around here tends to happen individually and at different times, kind of more ad hoc. And so to have a time once a month where we spend the morning just engaged, you know, together in activity as a sangha should be really wonderful. And it's practical, too. It helps us to get some things done that otherwise some volunteer, you know, off on their own does, so we can do more things together that way. So that's Saturday. That would probably be the 18th, maybe. 19th. And then the Friday night before that, our friends from the newly emerging Bellingham, is it Rime? Is that how you say it? Rime community are hosting a Tibetan Rinpoche here. So that's always fun. We've had Rinpoches here before, and they're always delightful. You don't even need to know them to know they'll be delightful. And I'm sure this is no exception. So he'll give us a talk about Tibetan medicine, the Tibetan understanding of medicine, on Thursday or Friday night. That'll be February 17th at 7:30. So I just added that to the website. And we're glad for the Dharma Hall to be used, you know, by many different teachers and compatible groups. So that's really wonderful. Thank you for bringing him. That'll be fun. I had a great the last time we had a Rinpoche here, he was forget his name right now, but anyway, we had a great time.
It was really
Argya Rinpoche, thank you. Argya Rinpoche. And his book is incredible. Did you read his book? Yeah. I can't remember anything. What's the name of his book? Something about the dragon. Surviving the Dragon. Surviving the Dragon, yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful book. Yeah, I could spend the whole talk talking about him, but I won't. But suffice it to say, he was born in 1950 in Tibet and had a very complicated and interesting time as a spiritual leader and of necessity a Communist Party official in Tibet. And then he finally had to leave, escape, which he did disguised as a Guatemalan tourist with a mustache. Yeah. I guess Guatemalans and Tibetans look similar. Yeah. And the last housekeeping announcement is just that at the very end of our practice period, March 1st through 4th, our guiding teacher, my teacher, Norman Fisher, will be here as well, and we'll have a three-day retreat, but it's people have known him for a long, long time, so they come from far and wide, so it's already almost full. So if you're planning to come to the retreat March 1st through 4th, you want to like sign up tonight if you can, maybe tomorrow. Yeah, but after that, you'll probably end up on the waiting list. So that's fun, you know. We'll really fill the place up. However, even if you don't come to the whole retreat, there are a couple different ways you can just show up and access the teachings and the community during that weekend. So you can look on the website. There's a talk that's public, and then there's a closing retreat for the whole practice period on the Sunday that you can just show up. So all is not lost if you don't get in. That's our thing, right? We want to get in. Or maybe we don't want to get in. But it's important, you know. If we do or we don't, it's a big deal. So those are my housekeeping announcements. And then before I launch into the sutra, I wanted to ask for yours. How is it going with this inquiry into the heart of the matter? There's a lot of us, so nobody could talk at any length. But does anyone want to say just a few words, maybe just a sort of a few impressionistic words about what that has been for you so far? This is the second week or so of practice period, so we're just kind of getting warmed up, but I was just curious, did anyone want to bring forward any observations or things that they've been experiencing? Yeah, Elizabeth.
It's like the question, who am I?
Uh-huh, yes.
It's the question that if it's part of my consciousness, there seem to be many opportunities for me to ask what the heart of the matter is.
Oh. So just bringing up the question changes your experience.
Yes. Oh. Brings it back to here. Oh. And makes a weaving and an umbilical connection with Zen. But it also connects me with my own purpose.
Uh-huh.
What am I doing?
So practicing with the question itself is interesting. Oh, thank you very much for sharing that. Yeah. Any other observations or things to let us know about? And whatever you say helps everybody, so that's, you do this as an offering. You're not like showing off or anything.
I've noticed that I'm pretty good at sarcasm.
Oh, yeah? I guess you are. Yeah, boy, our speech is... Boy. Thank you for sharing
how much
that.
I enjoyed listening to Norman's chant, the last lines here, the gate part. I don't have the tune down, but he
listening to Norman on
that
recording.
The way they chanted, it's little tune to it.
Hmm.
I don't remember the name. Huh? Anyway, I just really enjoy it.
Yeah. So, yeah, the heart of the matter could be, like,
yeah,
music,
yeah.
Yeah,
it'd
be music. Yeah.
Essentially
what he's doing. Yeah. So just mentioning again Norman Fisher and his website, everydayzen.org, has many, many recordings, including, like, two different series of lectures in the Heart Sutra, and I know he gave more than that, but they're just not on there. And I put a link to one of them that I was particularly moved by onto our website. And I don't know if you noticed, but I made a special page on our kind of revamped website. If you go, it's a link on the homepage too, but if you go teachings, I think, and then practice period. And as I'm working and preparing, I'm trying to remember to stick stuff there in case, just in case it's helpful. I don't, you know, you don't need to hang on my every word by any means, but just in case it's helpful. So I put on there one of the talks that he gave, yeah, which is a very beautiful talk. I'll mention it a little bit later. So listening, noticing our speech, working with questions, yeah.
I'm practicing the Heart Sutra as it is currently expressed, having memorized it many years ago as it formally was expressed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm chewing that. I'm hoping by the end of practice period it will have converted into
mm-hmm.
the present one, but it's really so hard to get my mind to do that. So, but every morning I'm doing
enchanting
it.
The current translation.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we changed translations, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully.
That's a good suggestion.
Good.
So I struggle with that same thing in eating. I find myself sort of comparing the old good Heart Sutra with the new bad. So I have to remind myself that they're all the Heart Sutra.
You don't have the opinion piece going. Yeah, every time you change the translation, it, you know, it solves some problems and creates new ones. It can't be helped. Okay, well, let's return to the sutra. If you are the kind of person where it is nice to be looking at words, what's nice about speaking about this sutra is it's really short, so it's just a couple of half pages in our chant book there. If you want to be looking at it, you don't have to. Page, what would that be? Page
five,
yeah. Page 5. And I also made a little handout, which I totally forgot to bring more of, comparing a few different translations. So we'll have to do that another week, looking at how the different translations shake out. So our version of the Heart Sutra, there are actually two versions, two recensions. And our version kind of starts right in the middle of the matter. Starts at the heart of the matter. Bonk. But there's a longer version, and maybe next week I'll bring those handouts. Maybe you might have gotten one last week, but I have a bunch of copies. There's a longer version, which ended up being popular in Tibetan Buddhism, that has kind of a frame story around it. So I'll just give you a rough sketch of the frame story, so you know. We read this at the retreat, I guess. You weren't all there. Kind of to sort of set the stage, but we'll look at that more carefully another week. So the frame story is that actually the Buddha's in the background, because a Buddhist sutra in some way comes from the Buddha. It could be the Buddha's speaking, or the Buddha's empowering someone else to speak. And so that's the sort of the great conceit of Buddhism and all religions, right? That there's a source, some kind of source that's trustworthy, a trustworthy source. So the trustworthy source here is Buddha. But as I mentioned last week, this Heart Sutra is a short version, a short part of a much larger literature that was written down definitely during the Common Era, probably about from 100 or 200, all the way up to about 800 or 900. Different pieces were added and changed. So over hundreds of years. Like, how we're so excited America's more than 200 years old, right? But this literature evolved over 700 or 800 years. But even at its beginning, maybe around 100 Common Era, that's already 400 to 600 years, we don't even exactly know when the Buddha lived, but 400 to 600 years after the Buddha. So did the Buddha say this? And to make it sort of work in a mythopoetic way, or maybe a sectarian way, the way the Mahayana, this sort of school of Buddhism, explains it is the Buddha gave these teachings later in his career. To just a few select people who are ready to hear them. And they realize that most people wouldn't be ready to hear these teachings. They're sort of too powerful, maybe, or too deep, or something like this. And this is a little bit sectarian, so you just need to know, and then you can forget about it. And so what they did is they gave them to the Nagas. They gave them to the Nagas for safekeeping. And the Nagas are these kind of serpent-like creatures that have a palace at the bottom of the ocean, the Naga Palace. And so the Prajnaparamita literature, this literature, must have been special waterproof scrolls that they had, was hidden by the Nagas, you know, until the world was ready, and then it was brought out. So that's a wonderful story. Or another way to look at it, which maybe fits our scientific sense of spirituality, is there's some essential essence, you know, there's some deep feeling for life that the Buddha brought to light with his original style of teachings. Even those weren't written down for hundreds of years, right? But his original style of teaching sort of set something in motion. Sometimes they say that the Buddha set a wheel in motion, set the wheel in Dharma in motion. And so, you know, everything in that wheel is from that initial nudge. Like you just nudge a boulder and it starts rolling downhill, right? So is it still the nudge, or is it the boulder, or is it the hill? We don't know. So maybe the Buddha set something in motion that later, you know, later teachers and students are continuing his spirit in a new form. So that's another way to look at it. There's a lot of ways to look at it. And you can look at it also in a sort of sectarian rivalry kind of way. But I was mentioning last week that even though there's these different Buddhist groups that we now call schools, they didn't call themselves school. That's a Western word that was added. They actually mingled quite a bit. And in the same monastery, you would have people from all different schools. So I was saying it would be like having a monastery with a Catholic monk and a Protestant monk and co-led by Martin Luther and the Pope in harmony, you know, more pretty much. So the Buddhists, we kind of map a certain Western worldview onto things, right? We can't help it, but just to know that this literature emerged later from a different school, but is it really so different and separate? And the point I want to try to make about the Heart Sutra and about this literature, which is going to reference, as we'll see, the earlier Buddhist teachings, is I don't think one is better than the other. I don't think one is better than the other. I think they complement each other and bring out different essential aspects in the spiritual life. And we're like so lucky. You know, we're so lucky that we're in a time and a place when all these things are available. You know, we're not bound by sort of sectarianism or a certain culture in which there's only one way of expressing and understanding Buddhist teachings. So we have all different levels available to us. And so then the challenge to us is how do we practice this with some care and some depth and some real feeling? You know, we're not just sort of like grazing, you know, lightly over the surface. So there's some depth here to be practiced with, to be sure. And I think it is probably the best to pick a tradition, ultimately, to pick a Buddhist tradition and practice deeply in that tradition, but to do so with some curiosity and some interest in what the other traditions are saying and how those other traditions are actually sort of informing and supporting and you know, enlivening your own tradition. So that's my little anti-sectarianism speech. So the frame story here. So anyway, there's two different versions of the sutra written, who knows when, 200, 300, common era. One has a frame story, which does have the Buddha to make it legitimate. So, you know, it's nice to know he's back there. Our version, he's even more back there because the word is not written down. And the Buddha is in a deep meditation, a very deep meditation in the background. And through that meditation, he empowers people to have a conversation that he feels, you know, needs to be said. And we still have a record of it today, you might say. And the two people that he empowered to have a conversation, one of them is definitely a sort of ordinary human being named Shariputra. And Shariputra was a historical figure. He was one of the chief disciples of the original Buddha. And he was known as a sort of master of wisdom. So appropriately enough, he's here in this Wisdom Sutra. Although as we see, we're going to a little bit use him as a fall guy. So Shariputra is a human being, a person. And the other person the Buddha empowers is Avalokiteshvara, which is the first word here, the first word in our sutra, who is kind of a human being and kind of beyond a human being, kind of an archetype. So Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva, and Bodhisattva is a sort of, you know, kind of guy. We don't really have an allegory for Bodhisattva in Christian myth, you know, Judeo-Christian thought. Kind of a person and kind of beyond a person, and an archetypal manifestation of a really helpful quality, really helpful quality. So Bodhisattvas are beings who are deeply devoted to helping others, to bringing others along. And so Avalokiteshvara, we have a statue here of one of her many representations. And she started out male, actually, in India in the early years in China, and then she became female. So that's pretty cool. So Bodhisattvas can change sex, depending on the circumstances. So Bodhisattvas are pretty darn flexible. And later on, look closer, our Avalokiteshvara, she's the Bodhisattva of compassion. Bodhisattva of compassion. So she has one hand held up in a special healing mudra, and the other hand she has a little scroll. And what is that scroll? That's this literature. That's the Prajnaparamita literature that she's holding. So her whole thing is love and compassion and caring. And one of her names in China and then in Japan, one of her names means she who hears the cries of the world. She who hears the cries of the world. And there's all kinds of different depictions of her. One of the best depictions, and we saw a statue of this in Kyoto, she like wanted to help so badly. Well, actually, two different things can happen to her body. Sometimes like she just like wants to help so badly. Sometimes her head explodes and she has seven different faces emerge with a little Buddha head on top so she can see and hear more people at once. That's one thing that happens. That's not what we saw. What we saw was the other thing that happens is she wants to help so much, she needs more arms, you know. She needs more arms. And so her body can emanate 1,000 arms. And in each arm there's a different helping tool or something that will help. So here's Avalokiteshvara. And so she's all about helping and compassion and love. And here she is an actor in this teaching on wisdom. And we talked a lot about wisdom already, so I'm concerned I don't repeat myself too much every week, but there are new people, so I want to be polite. But this wisdom is, we explored the way we come to the idea of wisdom with a sense of sort of a fixed body of knowledge, like being smart, knowing things, maybe applying knowledge in a smart way, but a sense of something that's sort of objectified, something that can be learned and mastered and passed on, something that has a sort of, I mean, not physical reality, but a kind of an intellectual reality. But the wisdom of Buddhism that we're going to be talking about here is a more effective, a more of a process wisdom, a wisdom that are actions of body, speech, or mind that help us get out of the ways that we're stuck, the ways that we're somehow confined by the way we look at the world. So the wisdom of Buddhism is a sort of liberating wisdom that's like more about not knowing than about knowing in a certain way, a sort of different kind of knowing. And so there's some interaction going on between compassion, and then behind me here, holding a sword over my head, is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who is Manjushri. And Manjushri, usually, let's see what this guy has. This Manjushri has a sword and a flower. Big flower. And in the middle of the flower there's another little scroll. Guess what? Same teachings. And so Manjushri is a little bit fierce if needed, you know, like tough love. If needed, Manjushri can slice off your delusions with his sword. And he's kind of androgynous looking, but he's usually considered male. But also holding a flower, also offering wise counsel, also kind. So sort of fierce and kind. And so you would think that Manjushri would be giving this teaching, but actually it's Avalokiteshvara, it's the Bodhisattva of compassion. So right away, we're setting up, from the title to the first word, we're setting up a kind of a coexistence of compassion and wisdom. That's really important. And in a way, it's like the whole teaching right there, that we need compassion and wisdom. You know, enough said. But the first line is kind of like the whole thing. Here's the whole teaching. And then the rest of the sutra is just attempting to, in some way, explain this first line to us. And in another way, encouraging us to forget about this first line and just enter into a kind of sacred space that the sutra evokes. So it's wonderful to hear that some people have been chanting the sutra. Because even though the sutra brings information forward, there's, you know, these are words, they, you know, it was written down in maybe Sanskrit, maybe Chinese, who knows. But it was written down in a language, these are meaningful words, and it was translated in English and it still means something. Some of them are technical Buddhist words that we have to kind of unpack. But there is, you know, there's a sort of philosophical, psychological, religious meaning here on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a magical kind of power to this whole thing as just, you know, like a mantra, like sort of mantric, esoteric kind of power, that just chanting it is seen as how it, also how it heals, also how it provides compassion and wisdom. It's just the chanting of it, just the doing of it, right? So this is a wisdom of doing. And all the Buddha sutras reference that, and oftentimes the Lotus Sutra is famous for this. I was talking to Edie earlier, we might study the Lotus Sutra in March. The Lotus Sutra will have whole patches that explain that all you have to do is recite one word of the sutra and all beings in all the worlds will be instantly liberated, free, and full of joy, and flowers will rain down from the heavens, and Buddhas will appear everywhere. Just one word, you know, because it's the kind of magic to it. You know? And, you know, I think we're, like, you know, now we're in religion. Uh-oh. It's a little bit hard on us, but I think it's an important part of our tradition that we have to take some different runs at to see if we can appreciate and feel. And that's why we do the chanting and the bowing and all this stuff, you know. It's sort of an appreciation of that side of the human experience that's sort of beyond what can be explained, sort of beyond what can be written down in meaningful words. There's something to this life that's sort of beyond psychology and science, much as we appreciate those things. So here's that first line. After the Buddha empowered Avalokiteshvara to practice, Avalokiteshvara, and we'll get that story more later, Avalokiteshvara saw something. She saw something. And of course she's been practicing already these practices for, like, you know, eons. But somehow in that moment something became a little more deep, a little more clear. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, so that's wisdom, Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. And she's going to explain a little more about that to Shariputra in the next paragraphs, the next lines. But let's pause there and see if we can unpack some of this a little bit. So right, one thing is notable, is deeply practicing. So there's a sense here of, you know, working with something over and over and over again in meditation practice and daily life, bringing up the things that you just brought up about the heart of your life. So this Bodhisattva was practicing, studying how is this in actual lived experience. And then she saw something about five aggregates and a quality of these aggregates, and that was a great healing. That relieved all suffering. So we need to know, what are these five aggregates? And what on earth does it mean to say that they are empty? And now, and many of you have heard these teachings many times. I know that. And some of you haven't. So let's just see what happens as we bring this up again. So emptiness is a really foundational part of Mahayana and Vajrayana, I think, too, thought, these later schools, that was also mentioned in the earlier Buddhism. And it has to do with a habit of mind that we have, that we all have, that is so deep and so pervasive that we really don't have a word for what they're trying to bring up here. Empty is a rough, very rough translation, The Sanskrit word that's used is shunyata, and shunya does also mean zero, the number zero. And so empty, I suppose, is maybe as good a translation as we're going to get. But it's referencing this incredibly powerful habit of mind that it just sounds silly to even talk about it. And the habit of mind is that things are separate and that they exist. Things are separate and they exist. And this seems to be saying that maybe that's not quite true in the way that we think it is. And when we say they're empty, there's something else implied. Something else implied. Which empty means like something's sort of not there, right? So what's not there? What's not there? And this translation leaves it out, but sometimes they say, they mention the word, and the other, another term, yet another Buddhist term, svabhava, that's fun, say that 10 times fast, svabhava, which means, kind of self-existent or own being. So let me take a little run at explaining emptiness, which is a concept that suggests that our concepts are flawed. So you get a little confused when you talk about it and when you listen to it. One way to think about this emptiness and this whatever this own being is to think about the boundaries between things. Think about the boundaries between things, right? Like we think this is a piece of wood, right? And it's just sitting here. It's not doing anything. It's completely passive. It's not changing at all. And it has a very definite edge, right? A very definite edge. It has a boundary. But actually, we also know from science that if we were to hook up our super electron magnetoscope and maybe put it on our iPhone or something so we can post this on YouTube, we would see that actually at the very edge of that wood, molecules are in fast motion. And electrons and neutrons and positrons are spinning around like crazy. And some of them are spinning off. And in fact, the wood is very slowly oxidizing and interacting with the oxygen such that you can tell the difference between new wood and old wood, right? If there were fixed boundaries around things, then things couldn't sort of move across them, right? Then molecules couldn't move across, things sort of couldn't change in a certain way. And then wood would always look exactly the same. And, you know, in a sort of conventional way, this lectern looks the same to me as it did last week. But we know that it's very slowly changing. That it doesn't contain a sort of essential, fixed sort of woodness, you might say. So you see, this gets really tangly when you try to talk about it. Sorry. But it actually is helpful to study this, and I'll try to get to why it's helpful. So this is, in a way, is a little arbitrary. You know, who cares about our lectern, you know? It's a nice oak. Bob Penny made it. It has a nice, and so it's actually a tree, I guess. And, you know, another way to look at this sort of lack of boundaries is to look at everything that's inside something. Look at everything that's inside something. And Thich Nhat Hanh, in his sweet little book about the Heart Sutra, which maybe you got a hold of, it's on the list of books that are suggested. He looks at it that way, in a very lovely way. And Thich Nhat Hanh's great gift is that he came up with a very simple way of explaining emptiness early in his career, and he stuck with it for like 50 years, giving the same teaching, you know, with great patience and joy, as if he'd never given it before, over and over and over. So it's a miracle, like amazing. So what he looks at is, so well, look at that wood. And if you sort of soften your gaze and open up your imagination, you can see, you know, a big, beautiful oak tree spreading out, you know, over the grass. And, you know, creatures living in it. And you can feel the rain falling in the roots of the oak tree. And you can feel the sun, you know, in the air, and, you know, and so on. So he has a nicer way of saying this than I do. That actually the lectern contains the sun, you know, contains the rain, contains the whole world. So there's no boundaries around it in that way either. And where this gets really interesting and really important is it's true for us too. It's true for us too. That we tend to think, you know, that we're separate, right? That we're sort of fixed in a certain way. We have an identity. We have a personality. We have things we're good at, things we're bad at. You know, we have hang-ups and blind spots and pride and joy and, you know, all these things. And this habit of mind that puts boundaries around things and holds things in a certain position does that to itself, such that we through, you know, and like I say, the idea is that this is such a powerful thing that we don't even see it happening. Such that we bind ourself. And is there even a self there at all? And so that's where meditation comes in. That's where practice comes in. Just talking about this, we just get tangled up, right? Even if you go back and listen to this recording 5 times, you'll still be like, yeah, Tim didn't get that one too well. Because of the nature of the material, nobody can get this one too well. You know, you can't, you know, nobody, well, maybe you can, but no one can. However, through meditation practice, as we've already been doing for as long, you know, all these years, however long we've been practicing, we can watch experience flow by, and we start to notice, oh, there was just a sensation in my knee. Oh, and then there was a thought. Oh, and then there was a feeling of the breath. There's experiences, there's a flow of experience. But if we look for it, we don't seem to be able to find, like, where's that me with his limitations and his history? Memories might arise. Is that me? Am I the sum of all my memories and my wishes for the future? And so that what these five aggregates are that we're being, that Avalokiteshvara is investigating. So the idea here is not that Avalokiteshvara took a great leap, you know, into philosophical space and had a great new idea. The idea is that she's been so carefully studying her experience, moment by moment, moment by moment, day by day, for years, for lifetimes, that she started to, it started to gradually become more and more clear, just like sort of reconditioning this habit of mind. The same way that we bring the mind back to the meditation object, like bringing it back to the breath. It's not like we ever expect, okay, here's another way to think about this. It's not like we ever expect, one of these days, I'm going to get it. And then the mind will stay on the meditation object permanently. It would be a little problematic because we'd have to like sort of pick you up off the cushion and, you know, throw a glass of water in your face to get you, like, come back, you know. You need your personality now. You know, so we don't think that way, right? So there's a sense here of endless process, always coming back. And the reason why we need an endless process is because the way it's understood is this way of looking at the world, the depth of this sort of conditioned view, it goes back, you know, to endless time. The Buddha says nobody knows, you know, nobody knows why it started out this way. There's no beginning to this. It's a beginningless situation. And so Avalokiteshvara, you know, who knows how long she practiced studying these five aggregates. So let's talk about what these five aggregates are. So I'm going to write them down for those of you who are, you know, need to see words written down. And hopefully I will not go on too long, because we have to do some things where we actually have some experiences. Otherwise it's all for naught. We'll just gather up some more knowledge that you will fix, right, in place. So these five aggregates, the idea of these five aggregates, and aggregate is a translation of a Sanskrit and Pali word spelled the same, which is skanda, yeah, so sometimes the translation is five skandas, but in that case it's a very pedestrian word that's being translated. It's just the word in Sanskrit for heaps. There's nothing special or mystical about it. Yeah, heaps or aggregates or just groups, you know, it just means group, a group. And, you know, you use that for like a pile of rocks. There's a skanda of rocks, you know, so it's not like a special technical term. It's just what Buddha chose to use. So what Buddha was saying is, if you study your experience carefully, you'll find that every moment of experience breaks down into five categories of experience. And if you can see it that way and investigate it in that way, it'll loosen these ropes, you know, loosen the binds that hold you into a certain position as a person. And let's see, we'll do the Sanskrit and the first one makes a lot of sense. So, yeah. So the first one. Oh, let's see, we'll work with these. I don't know, you know. Does that work? Yeah, kind of. So the first one is, the Sanskrit word is rupa, and this one is a pretty straight translation. This one's easy. So it means just physical form. Physical form. Oh, thanks. Let's see if that works. Yeah, kind of. So one aspect of experience, this is pretty common sense, one aspect of experience is physical form. So you can feel the body. You can feel the breath in the body. there's a physicality to existence, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that being the case. That, you know, that is in fact the case. But is your body you? You know, is your the whole body is you, but how about just the fingernail? Is the fingernail you? So when you trim your nails, what's happening there? You know. So that's one aspect of experience. And so the Buddha is saying, and the Mindfulness Sutra is the famous explication of how to do this, how to practice the five skandhas. The Mindfulness Sutra says, for a while, a year, a decade, just notice the physicality of existence. Let go of thought, let go of emotion, let go of all the things and the stories you're telling and the things you project and the ideas you have. Just feel, you know, just experience physicality of existence. So that's the first aggregate, the first skanda. So that's good, and we should all do that. And that's part of why I wanted to offer a little bit of yoga before the seminar, if you have time to come early for that. It's not because I'm a great yoga teacher or we're going to all open up our hips and sit full lotus. It's just to experience physicality in a certain way. The second one, we have to use the Sanskrit. I'll write the common English translation, but it's misleading. And the second one doesn't show up very much in Western psychology or thought either. So here's an area where we're learning something new from the Buddha and from the Indian philosophical tradition that he was basing all this on. He didn't just make all this up. So the second one is Vedana, which is translated as feeling. But we use feeling in so many different ways, it's not a very good translation. Like, you know, there's a feeling, a physical touch feeling, there's feelings like emotions. And this is a very particular kind of feeling, which we can experience, you know, we should experience, which is that as soon as we perceive anything, even before we even think about it or give it a sort of conceptual label, as soon as we perceive anything, that the body-mind apparatus tends to lean into it or lean out of it, tends to see everything as like a positive thing or a negative thing, right? So duality is a baked-in low-level thing, or maybe neutral, but it's hard to notice neutral. So the most common way they express these three categories. So feelings, this Vedana, is a way of sort of breaking that the body-mind, without our even having to think about it, just seems to happen very quickly, very automatically, sort of sorts experience into these three categories. They usually say pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And so you can meditate on that, too. You can meditate on that, too, and you should. You really should. You know, just, and let's, you know what? Enough talk. We've been sitting here a while. Let's stand up a minute just to kind of get the physicality stretched out a little bit. And if you're listening to this at home, you should do the same. And then let's we'll do a little standing meditation. We don't often meditate standing, so let's do that. Let's do a little standing meditation. So we can, if you want to stand on your mat, that's comfy, you can, or just on the floor. And eyes could be closed unless it makes you dizzy, then just gaze down. So start to just touch into the, you know, we always start with rupa in a certain way. It's skillful to start with rupa. So first feeling the body and feeling the breath. So the breath in the body is also a physical experience. So, you know, trying as best we can to let go of thought and just return to the feeling of breath in the body. And then, you know, and this is a very brief practice, so you might want to go back with a lot more time. Start to open up the sort of inner and outer sense gates. So you're just noticing everything that's being experienced right now. So physical sensations, emotions, thoughts, sounds from next door, sounds in the room. Open up to all that experience and see if you can be alert for a sense of what feels pleasant and what feels a little bit unpleasant, and what you sort of like or sort of don't like within that whole sort of sphere of experience happening right now. To notice what are the pleasant sensations or experiences, and what are the unpleasant ones. Okay, I'm here taking a deep breath. If you want to stretch just a little bit one more time, embrace that physical body, and then let's sit back down. We have more work to do. So this, you know, this Vedana, I mean, it's, since it's not a sort of lens of perception that we're so used to, I mean, we think about our emotional life a lot. You know, someone asks you, how are you? And we have a whole little way that we process our thoughts and emotions. We notice pains and sometimes pleasant sensations in the body, but we don't so much notice this pleasant and unpleasant, because what happens very quickly in the mind is it gets elaborated on, right? It gets elaborated on. Very soon it's an opinion, a well-justified opinion, I must say, right? Pretty soon it's a generalization, it's the way things always are, or it's a judgment. Why does she do that, you know? And so you can see the sort of obvious, you know, sort of psychological even utility of being aware of Vedana. This, the Heart Sutra is going to take this a step further, but we need to know the step before. And the obvious step before is if we can perceive our experience in a little more of a sort of baseline way, a little closer to the bone, a little closer to the moment of experience. Sometimes we don't have to go there, you know. But it's a different thing than trying to convince yourself, don't be so judgmental, which is another kind of a judgment, right? To just see if we can be a little closer to the actual experience in this moment and say, oh, unpleasant. And sometimes you don't have to elaborate on why it's unpleasant and why she really should have given you that and, you know, whatever it is, you know, right? Which is a sort of a diffusing thing. So there's an obvious utility to that. But and the implication here is Avalokiteshvara had already studied all this, you know, in great depth. And then she saw another layer, you know, even beyond that, which we'll get to, I hope, sometime. First we need five skandhas before we negate them. And you might have noticed chanting the Heart Sutra that there's a lot of negation going on, which is, people don't like it too much. It's maybe it's a little bit unpleasant. To practice the Heart Sutra in a certain way, so we need to find out what they mean by all that negation, and is there something positive going on? So the third aggregate. So again, these are categories of experience. They aren't really sort of things. They're categories of our experience. The third aggregate is this one is also a pretty straight translation. I think it's perception. I don't even remember the Sanskrit. It's like shana. I'll just do perception. I'm not sure how to pronounce the Sanskrit. And there are other schemes of Buddhist psychology that look at a sort of process by which experience happens and gets processed and gets turned into thinking and personality and then vanishes again. So this is touching into that too. But the third aggregate is just perception itself. Perception itself, without conceptualization, without labels, without thought, just the very act of the eyes interact in some way with vision. and there's something that happens, right? The ears interact in some way with something. Something happens. So, you know, the sound before. So, like for example, you know, our usual way of thinking is, I heard a bird, right? And so in Buddhist phenomenology, there's a lot more going on, which, you know, we can well believe is there, you know. A sound comes in contact, you know, they have all kinds of ways of talking about it, right? A sound comes in contact with, you know, the ear organ, and there's an ear consciousness that arises, and it goes on and on, very complicated. But in our study of what is our actual lived experience, you know, our kind of, in a way, it's a kind of way of deconstructing the self, right? You notice that already. We can also just work with perception itself. Just see what you're really seeing. And when you practice that way, you notice how quickly you see something and look away because you already know what that is. You don't need to look at it. But did you really see it, you know? Or did you see a little bit of visual information that touched into some concept in, you know, deep storage, and then your brain filled in the rest? And, you know, and they do studies of memory and perception in psychology, and it seems to be very clear, that most of what we think we perceive is what our brain filled in. Most of what we think we perceive what our brain filled in. And so they do. Here's my favorite study. I've probably mentioned this 3 or 4 times because I think it's so funny. So you want to hear this little story about perception in the mind, which is why this, part of why this is important to practice with, is they did this experiment at Harvard. I think it was in Harvard, college campus, where they had one agent of the researchers grabs some student and starts asking them for directions, like directions to some obscure building. Like, I went up to Western the other day and nobody knew the building I was asking about. So that kind of thing. And so the student's scratching their head and trying to remember the best way to say it. And then two more agents of the experimenter walk in between the two of them carrying like a big piece of plywood, like dressed as construction workers or something like that. And at the same time, the person asking the directions is replaced by somebody who looks completely different. And something like 70-something percent of the time, the student just continues the conversation. Does not notice, you know, that he's not talking to somebody. And this, from our point of view of thinking that we're accurately perceiving the world and the brain is kind of like a video VCR that records every moment of memory and can play it back later accurately. And, no, you said that. I heard you say it, you know. That's how we think things work. But, you know, Buddhist teaching and psychological, you know, experimental psychology seems to suggest no, you know. The brain was on some visual thing about the layout of the campus and did not actually see this guy. Did not actually really see him. You know, enough happened that the person recognized there's a person there, but didn't really see him. So to work with perception, you know, to actually see somebody. And you know, people, and if you hang out with people who, you know, have done a lot of Buddhist practice or any kind of spiritual practice, that's one of their qualities. Have you noticed that? There's a sense of really being seen, isn't there? Really, they're not sort of thinking about what they think you look like, you know, really being seen. So two more. Oh no, we're running out of time. So that's the first three. Thanks. The fourth one is kind of a complicated one, so which we'll just do a kind of a catch-all for. And it's, how do you spell it? Yeah, this one has different spellings in Sanskrit and Pali. We'll use the Sanskrit. It's samskara. 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 And this is kind of a catch-all for a lot of mental processes. So I think to save us time, we'll just translate samskara as thoughts. As thoughts. As thoughts. So this is a huge thing, though. Just to say just thoughts is not no small thing. Because that's an area where we most identify with our experience and most impute our selfness and do. So the Buddha talked about me-making and I-making. So we do a lot of me-making and I-making when we're thinking about things. And so, you know, we've experienced this in meditation. How freeing it is. What a relief it is. If we can see a thought as a thought. See a thought as a thought. It's not a failure. It's not a problem. It's not like we weren't smart enough, or on the other hand, we need to hop up and write that down because it's a brilliant idea. It's just a thought arising out of the conditions in our life. Just a thought. So to see thoughts as thoughts. And the word samskara also has one of the roots has to do with volition, with the urge to do something. And so that's kind of nice to just know in the background that thought has this quality of pulling us along, doesn't it? You know, you think something, and next thing you know, you're doing something, right? Mm-hmm. So to actually, another way to study thought and to study samskara is to notice that sort of urge before you actually do something, that volitional impulse, to notice that as an experience itself, and which we don't often do, right? We're just already onto the action. So thought or volitional impulse is samskara. And the fifth one to finish our work for the evening is consciousness. Consciousness. Which is another area where we identify. We think we are our consciousness. Sanskrit is vijñāna. But this has actually a different, little bit different meaning in Buddhist psychology than in sort of everyday language, where we're not really that clear what we mean when we say consciousness. But consciousness in Buddhism is actually a kind of layer of perception. Consciousness is a layer of perception. There are different kinds of consciousnesses. The one we think of as kind of me is the consciousness that can perceive thought. So it sort of follows the fourth one very logically. And this is interesting to think about it. If you're in meditation and you can ground yourself to where you can notice a thought arising, you know, a thought is a thought. So who's thinking? You know, and who's observing the thinking? And since we exist in our conception of ourselves as a single being, right? We think that we're one person, more than one. It's not good to be more than one person. That's like split personality, get locked up. So, but it seems like experientially, there are a lot of processes happening, and is any one of them me? That's kind of the question. And this is all early Buddhism. This is all early Buddhism. This is just like the starting point, the takeoff point, you know, where the Heart Sutra takes off into emptiness. And so we can study, so the other kinds of consciousness are mentioned, like with the ears. The way it's understood is there's a special kind of consciousness that's the consciousness that's able to perceive sound, which is different from the consciousness that perceives thought. And there's a whole other system that has another layer of consciousness, which is kind of like Jung's collective unconscious. So we'll talk about that another time. It sort of is accessing this sense, which I think is helpful. You know, there's this sense that there's something, even if we boiled all this down and figured all this out and had this accurate perception of each moment of experience and all these processes that are happening, there's still a sense of something bigger is actually going at play here, isn't there? Do you know what I mean? There's a sense of something broader than any version of me that we can come up with, including this wise Buddhist inquiry. So, we shall have to say more later about the five skandhas, but I want to bring that up because the suggestion for you this next week is, well, pick one or two of these and in your meditation practice at home and walking around, see if you can just inquire, you know, in your life. Is it possible to sort of see experience within as a manifestation of one or more of these categories? And it's not a matter of sort of forcing yourself to have a particular experience. None of, you know, we're never trying to have a particular experience or attain a particular state or something like that in Buddhist practice. It's more a matter of coming, observing or coming at our lived experience with a little different perspective. So that's the usefulness of teachings. Teachings are not to straighten you out, you know, or make you different or better or something. Teachings are tools, you know, ways of looking at experience that can be illuminating or interesting in some different way. So, I mean, form, just to feel the physicality of existence, on the cushion at home, going about the day. I really like Vedana. It's really helpful to have some experience with Vedana. You know, what's positive, what's negative in this experience? And this is especially powerful in relationship, right? Like my favorite is at the grocery store. Like you're coming around the aisle and there's someone you know you should say hello to. You don't want to. Right? So there's some positive and negative right there, you know. And you practice with that and then you be polite, you know, and go say hello. So, or perception, you know. See, I avoided you at the store and I learned really interesting things in Buddhist psychology. My teacher really, you know. Yeah, you can call him up. And perception, just to perceive a little more directly. So a lot of these things seem to be supported by slowing down a little bit, like naturally. So to pause, you know, to pause and perceive, like walking out the door, what do you actually see in front of your door? Have you really looked, you know? And thoughts, to be aware of thoughts, and consciousness is a little bit harder for consciousness to be aware of consciousness, especially when we're riled up by the day, but these are worthy of inquiry. And that's what the beginning of our sutra is all about, Avalokiteshvara. Understood all this and then saw an even deeper level to it that we shall get into next week, hopefully. Let's see, I have about 5 other things I want to do in 5 minutes. So let me just prioritize for a moment. Well, I think the most important thing, I've given you lots of information. And there's lots more in my little wad here. I really don't know how to prepare for this seminar. You know, I can't seem to write it out, so I just have an increasing pile of stuff that I bring. My little envelope's getting thicker and thicker. Yeah, exactly. It's all empty. I think the best thing to do would be to sing to you. So let's do that. I was listening in the car on the way back from Seattle the other day. I first heard a beautiful talk by Norman, so it's nice you mentioned Norman. And I put a link to it on that section of our website. Norman was doing a seminar on the Heart Sutra in 2009. And in between the first and second meeting of that seminar, his dearest friend died, just out of the blue, just went out for a walk and died. Nobody knows why. And so he was talking about his friend, and you could really hear in this talk the way the Heart Sutra is really a support, not for like some kind of a cold, impersonal wisdom, but the Heart Sutra really is a support for love, you know, really is a support for connection, that letting go of these boundaries around things allows a kind of softening and a kind of emerging. So I was thinking about that, and it's a very sad and beautiful talk that he gave, and you can listen. Even if you don't know Norman particularly, it's really quite moving. You know, and he's not crying and blubbering, he's talking. He's still teaching about the Heart Sutra, but there's a very sweet quality to it. And then after that, I had enough of, you know, Dharma talks, and I still had more to drive, so I put on some music. So I was listening to Tracy Chapman. And I heard this Tracy Chapman love song that I had not heard before. So I've attempted to learn it so I can sing it to you. Yeah. We'll see, I actually spent more time on Tracy Chapman than the Heart Sutra when I was preparing this morning. Because it's kind of a hard song. Because, yeah, ultimately this all does seem to be, in the end, a kind of a wisdom that expresses as love. And in our culture, romantic love is our fullest, most comfortable expression of that love. But I think as we study the heart of the matter and study our life, we realize that romantic love is just one form of love. And really there's something deeper to love than that, but this is a romantic love song because that's what we're good at. Later we can write a Heart Sutra love song. If you wait for me, then I'll come for you. Although I've traveled far, I always hold a place for you in my heart. If you think of me. If you miss me once in a while, then I'll return to you. I'll return and fill that space in your heart. Remembering your touch, your kiss, your warm embrace, I'll find my way back to you if you'll be waiting. If you dream of me like I dream of you, in a place that's warm and dark, in a place where I can feel the beating of your heart. Remembering your touch, your kiss, your warm embrace, I'll find my way back to you if you'll be waiting. Oh, I've longed for you, and I have desired to see your face, your smile, to be with you wherever you remembering your touch, your kiss, your warm embrace, I'll find my way back to you. Please say you'll be waiting. Together again, it would feel so good to be in your arms where all my journeys end. If you can make a promise, it's the one that you can keep. And say you'll hold a place for me in your heart. A place for me in your heart. A place for me in your heart. Thanks very much.